I was leading two sets to love, and then I was like, you know, I get cooked by the sun, and for two sets I was really struggling. So the first, when I won the match point, I thought, okay, I have no more to play. That's it. Then under the shower, I realized that I became Olympic champion. But right after the match, it was not the case.
What would be the few things that you would say to describe Roger Federer as a player, as a person, as an athlete?
For me, the most important about Roger is his personality. You know, once I remember talking to a journalist and I said that Roger and Rafa, they were like twins. And the guy looked at me and said, how can you say that? They play completely different. I say, yes, but the way they're humble. I think they receive a hell of a good education.
How did Roger change not just Swiss tennis, but Switzerland in general? Because he's such a popular figure now.
I just put the location of Switzerland on the map. Because I remember at that time, you know, I was like, even in the States, I used to say, I'm Swiss. Sweden. No, Switzerland, it's different, you know.
All right, welcome everyone to another Tennis Worthy podcast presented by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McAdoo, the president of the Hall of Fame. Very excited for my next guest. We go way back, played on the tour a little bit, similar in age. He's a few years younger than me, and he had a slightly better serve than me, known for his big serve. Actually, one of the tallest players in that era, and Mark Rosé could play on every service. In fact, he won titles on each of the four services, including, of course, winning the gold medal at the Olympic Games in 1992. Mark, welcome to the show. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for your invitation, Patrick.
Anytime. So, you know, obviously we know that when people think of Swiss tennis right now, they think of the great Roger Federer. But before Roger came along, there was Jakob Hlasek, there was you, and you sort of laid the groundwork for, you know, maybe what Roger Federer could become, because Swiss tennis didn't have an amazing history. Tell us the first time you ever laid eyes on Roger Federer with a tennis racket in his hand.
I was already on the tour, and I think Roger was 16. I heard about him. He was practicing near Lausanne. I mean, it's like 60 kilometers from Geneva in the National Center. And so I wanted to meet him. So I organized a practice in Geneva. He came there. We started to practice. And the guy was so relaxed. I mean, we couldn't make like a five ball in the court. You know, it was mistakes. But he was like not nervous at all. He was... I would not say lazy, but he was so relaxed. And after 5 minutes, I was like talking to my coach and said, I love this guy. I love this guy.
What was it about his game that you noticed right away? Because you had an all-court game. You had the big serves. You could come to net.
No, but he was a really, really relaxed guy. I mean, he was 16. I mean, he was like, you could not see really his potential, you know. And then 2 years after, he did some good results in the junior. So I remember we were like playing Spain in La Coruña in Davis Cup. So we took him for like 5 days and, you know, that he can practice with the team and I make sure that he had the next room to my room, you know, the communicating room.
Right.
The first thing I did is open the room to make him feel welcome, plug the PlayStation and we start to play games. And the guy was so relaxed, you know. I remember like after coming back after a tough practice on clay and the guy was in my room playing on my PlayStation and I almost have to kick him out of my room, you know. I said, Roger, can I have like just a, like 30 minutes relax? You know, I need to recover a little bit.
And how did he handle those practices, you know, playing with the big boys for the first time as a teenager?
No, he was playing good. I mean, his backhand was a little bit weak, but otherwise you could see that he has like, he was gifted. To be honest. And then, you know, we played his first final we played together. He was in Marseille. I beat him like 7-6 in the third. And he was like, you're crying after the final. And I said, man, why you cry? And he said, maybe it was my only chance to win a title. So I remember at that time, you know, doing the speech on the court after the final saying that, okay, guys, you have a future champion in front of you. And I said, Rog, you're going to win title. But I could not imagine to win like so many titles, you know. I was sure he wouldn't do a career, but you cannot see when you play a guy who's 18, 19, that you say, okay, he's going to win so many titles.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, now that we have the opportunity to look back on his career and the 20 majors and all the titles and all the services, What do you think Roger Federer, I mean, because you obviously the great tennis history, but as I said, you, Jakob Plasek, you won the doubles, by the way, here at the French Open with Jakob in 1992, the same year you won the Olympic gold. You also helped Switzerland get to the final. But how did Roger change not just Swiss tennis, but Switzerland in general? Because he's such a popular figure now all over the world, you know, almost like a global icon in addition to being this incredible tennis player.
I just put the location of Switzerland on the map because I remember at that time, you know, I was like, even in the States, I used to say, I'm Swiss. Sweden. No, Switzerland, it's different, you know. Now I think that everybody knows where Switzerland is on the map.
Well, he certainly did that. And when he lost that final to you, and I think you played him three more times. I think you beat him the next time, and then he beat you two times once you gotten a little bit more established. What did you notice about, you mentioned the backhand was a little bit weak, you know, as a teenager. What was the strength of his game? Because if you beat him 7-6 in the third, obviously it was very close match that first time you beat him.
You know, I beat him two times, two times 7-6 in the third, and he kicked my ass. And I remember the day he wanted to, we were practicing at Wimbledon, you know, you can use this court, you know, half an hour, 1 hour before the tournament starts, you know. And at that time, he was with Peter Carter, and it's the year he won his first Wimbledon. We did practice, we played a set. It just like, I looked like I was a junior. He was playing so good. And I remember saying to Peter, I said, he can do good this year. Then I realized that he had really a potential. At that time, that day, I really figured out that he's a champ.
So that was a year he beat Philip Poussis, you remember, for his first Wimbledon. I was actually commentating on the match, and Cliff Drysdale, you know, who was my long-time partner, so much history he had in tennis, and he had, when Roger won, I looked over at him, and he had tears in his eyes, and this was very unusual. I mean, Cliff was, you know, been doing this for a long time, and he was just kind of so moved by the way he played. I always like to say he brought, like, the old-school type of tennis to the modern era. You know, you were a guy that had the big serve with the, you know, the new rackets. Everybody was hitting the ball hard. He was able to corral the control and kind of play that old school style while injecting, you know, so much more pace into his shots. How do you think he was able to pull all that together?
When you speak about Roger, you have to first thank his physical coach, Pier Paganini.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work with him 10 years. I reached top 10, gold medal. He worked with Rog. He worked with Stan Wawrinka. For me, he's one of the best physical coach. And talking about the backhand of Rog, I don't think it was any technical problem. It was his footwork was not correct on the backhand side. And as soon as he fixed this with Pier Paganini, he became a different player.
Yeah, I think people underestimate the work that Roger did off the court, right? Because when you watch him,
He did a lot on the footwork. I mean, Pierre was really a tough guy, you know. Paying a lot of attention of the footwork, how you move your legs, if you're in the correct position before hitting your shot. And Roger improved his backhand when his footwork became good.
Right. And I know that when you, you know, that 92 year when you led Switzerland in the final, you guys lost the final, but then it was 2014 when finally Switzerland won it when Roger was on the team. What did that mean to you? Because you had kind of, I mean, to get Switzerland at that time to the final was a huge effort, and you were the leader of the team, but it was sort of a culmination of what you started to see Roger and obviously Stan being part of the team as well.
I was happy. I was, you know, it was like at the end of the circle because even if at that time we play your brother, Pete Sampras, Jim Courier, and Andre Agassi was like a dream team, you know.
Right, and you won a huge match against Courier in five sets.
Yeah, and we lost like five sets in the doubles against your brother and Pete. I mean, so imagine to have like fifth playing only doubles in a team. You know,
unbelievable. I remember. I was there. I was watching it. Yeah,
And I was like, you know, this sore taste in my mouth. So I was very happy that those guys could finally win the title for Switzerland.
What do you think it will be like? I mean, Roger, as we know from just what you've told us here already, you know, was so relaxed. What we saw over the years, we saw it when he lost to you in that first final. It was very emotional, right? And he was emotional when he won. He was emotional when he lost. But as you said, he was so relaxed. So to me, it was like, I remember when he lost to get killed the 1 year by Rafa in the final here in Paris, when he won like three games that 1 year. And most people would have just been so devastated, like for months, but he just brushed it off his shoulder. I tell the story that he still had a party with all his friends and family that were there that came to see the final. How did he have that mindset that he could be relaxed, be emotional, yet let the wins and the losses kind of roll off his back and go on to his next goal?
I don't know. The guy is special. He's definitely special because few times I saw him in the tournament in Basel, his hometown. After matches, you know, he's playing night session. Then, you know, in the locker room, the guy met another Swiss famous like cycling or whatever. And the guy can speak like an hour and a half with the guy, you know.
Yeah.
And basically, the other guy has to top the conversation. He still has to do the press. He still has to do the things. And I say, Raj, how can you spend so much time? And he say, you know, I'm here at the moment. Next thing is another things. Then it's another things. You know, it's not like thinking, okay, I have to do this, tomorrow I have to do that. He's really living in the present, enjoy every single minute he's doing the thing. So he's not like pushing himself to do things, you know? It's like he enjoyed the moment he's living.
He seems to enjoy being around people, like when he's there. I think that's the one thing, you know, I've come across. You have the Rafa fans, the Roger fans, you know, the Novak fans. But there's something about Roger's ability to connect with people, right? I've heard that from a lot of people, some of the Swiss journalists that have covered him over the years I've spoken to as well. It's like he's able to just be right there in the moment. And I think that's why he was able to play the game, you know, his talent, number one, but also enjoy the game and enjoy, you know, the grind of the travel. Like for most of us, we're like, oh, we're so tired from traveling all the time. He's really enjoyed it, didn't he?
And also he did another smart thing. He used to stay to different hotels from the players, not because he wants to be, you know, like hiding or whatever. It's just to get fresh. Mm-hmm. You know, he stayed to another hotel, he's playing the match, then he's going back to his hotel, he play with his kids. So he's not thinking about tennis.
Right.
You know, so he's thinking about tennis when it's time to think about tennis. And as soon as the match is over, then he goes with his family, he's play kids, he told me stories, you know, he can like playing in the suite and the this and that. And he did break also. I mean, if you see the way he was doing his season, you know, he was playing Australian Open, then he had a break, doing some physical practice, block with Pierre Paganini, then playing like another three tournaments, then maybe 10 days off, doing a physical block again. So he was not playing that much, you know, in terms of amount of tournaments. So he could have time off tennis, and then he was focusing on tennis. He was totally focusing on tennis. And also, you have to admit that his wife is like, he owns like 50% of his results because she was, no, you need to have a certain person next to you, you know, push you, support you. And she did help him a lot with a lot of things. I mean, one year, I think she gave birth to the second twins, and she said, okay, go to play Rome. It's okay, I'm fine.
Right. Amazing, because, well, she knows, because she was a very good player herself. So they met, I remember at the Olympic Games when they met. You're still the only Swiss player to win the gold in singles, Mark.
Yeah, we have an arrangement with Roger. I say, you can win
everything
as much
else
as you want, but you leave me this one.
But you know, that interesting, when he won the Olympics in the doubles with Stan, he was sort of at a little bit of a lull for him in winning majors. And that seemed to kind of rekindle his spark again for tennis. One of the few times in his career, I think he would say, you know, maybe he was a little bit down on just his game. But that was always very important to him to winning the gold in a lot of ways. In doubles was incredibly important to him, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it seems to be the same thing for like Boris Becker winning in 92 with Stich. I mean, when I heard him, like, it was like something really important for him. And you play for your country. You know what is it, you know, when you play Davis Cup or Olympics, it's something special because you have more attention. A lot of people don't follow, for example, tennis. But when it comes to Olympics or Davis Cup, because of this is the country, they will watch the game. So it's always like special emotion. And for him, it was really important.
Well, for you, I mean, you had some huge wins during when you had your run to win the gold. Courier amongst them, that was on the clay in Barcelona. And then it was a 5-set final against Jordi Aresti, who had the hometown crowd. He was a little rugrat on the clay. So what are your memories about the matches that you played to win that gold medal?
My first, after the match point, the first memory was a kind of a relief that I don't have to play anymore tennis ball.
Because I remember it was very hot. It was so hot, right?
I was leading two sets to love, and then I was like, you know, I get cooked by the sun, and for two sets I was really struggling. So the first, when I won the match point, I thought, okay, I have no more to play. That's it. Then under the shower, I realized that I became Olympic champion. But right after the match, it was not the case.
Amazing. So what do you think will be the emotions for Roger coming to Newport? You know, it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful old grass court. It's a museum. He loves the history of the sport. How do you think that's going to hit him when he shows up there?
I think he will be really touched because Roger is a guy of tradition, you know. That's why he did the Lever Cup. He has a hell of a respect for former players before him, for the new generation. He knows the history of sports more than anybody else. You know, you could ask him, you know, who won the Grand Slam, or how many guys there, Emerson, you know, all those guys. And I think this is very important because a lot of young players, when you speak with them, you say, okay, who was Roy Emerson?
Right.
I don't know. The guy won 12 Grand Slam. It's part of the history, and to understand the tennis, no, I think you need to understand also who did what 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago. You know, I think it's quite, for me, it's quite natural, you know, to have interest of who was the former players, why the rules changed, the history of the games. So I think it will be very, very important for you.
Yeah, no, it's going to be awesome. And the museum there is beautiful. And there's obviously a lot of buzz about Roger's coming to Newport and his appearance there. What do you think that, you know, somebody who doesn't, you know, let's say in 50 years and someone who doesn't really know the history that you're talking about, what would be the few things that you would say to describe Roger Federer as a player, as a person, as an athlete, as sort of a global figure? Like, how would you describe him?
For me, the most important about Roger is his personality. This is like, for me, you know, once I remember talking to a journalist and I said that Roger and Rafa, they were like twins. And the guy looked at me and said, how can you say that? They play completely different. I say, yes, but the way they're humble, I think they receive a hell of a good education. Humility on the court. They are fair, you know, they don't try to cheat. And when they go to the press and they speak the truth. So I think those guys, they're like twins. And Roger, I mean, I don't know how to describe him because I know him, you know, he's like a little brother for me. So, but I always did care when he was on the tour or when I stopped my career and I was doing commentating. And I always did care that he's a happy man. That was the most important for me.
Yeah, because you remember him when he was a kid. I love that story about him coming over, you know, you opening the doors and the PlayStation and, you know, I'm sure he remembers that.
Yeah, because that's why, you know, sometimes I remember one year after Wimbledon, he invited me to this right after the match, you know, you have a special place and introduced me to a few famous people like his big brother.
Wow.
Because I was kind of, I think I was a kind of big brother for him. You know, I wanted to make sure when he came on the tour that if he need anything, any tips, that he feel welcome, that he feel secure, that if anything happened, I would be there for him.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Speaking with Mark Rosset, Olympic gold medalist and top 10 player in singles and doubles for in his career. All right. So I want to ask you a little bit about when Roger came back from the knee injury and Rafa had been, you know, beating him in some major finals and Ivan Ljubicic then came on board as his coach, who we know well, had a great back end. And Roger was able to sort of add a little something to that, you know, especially that backhand side. He switched rackets. He was very stubborn. He didn't want to switch. Talk about that transition for him and how that helped him, you know, win Australia and then go on and win another Wimbledon.
Listen, I have a different story about this backhand and Ljubicic.
Okay, let me hear.
Everybody, when Roger, it was 2017, when he beat Rafa in the final in the Australian Open, and everybody said, ah, Ljubicic, backhand, something changed, technique, this and that. So.
Mm-hmm.
I was supposed to go on the TV studio to speak about the final. I have no clue because I was trying to check the backhand, if the grip changed, if the technique changed, if something changed. And so when I don't know, you know, I have an easy way to do it. It's like I call Seve Lüthi, who has been working 15 years. So I call Seve back in Australia and I say, Seve, I have to go on TV. Tell me honestly, what I have to say about the backhand? He said, nothing. I said, why? He said, because we just practice that he feel, basically he practiced physically to be really fast to cover the court after the return.
And take it a little earlier.
Yeah. On the right side,
right,
on his forehand side. And he was so comfortable to cover that court on the forehand side that he was feeling good to go inside the return with the backhand, knowing that it can be fast enough, not losing the point on the second shot on the right side. So he was just that, knowing that he's so comfortable with his forehand on the second shot that he was going through the ball on the return. So it was nothing about the technique. It was just mental things.
So mental things you need. And he'd done the physical work. Yeah.
Go inside the court, go inside your return, because you can cover the court on your right side better than everybody. You can take the ball so quick. So it was more like an approach. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was more like a mentality. It wasn't
It was nothing about technique. You don't change the technique to a guy who's like 37, you know, for pre-season.
Did the new racket help, though? You think
the new racket did help me a lot. That's for sure.
Maybe gave him a little pop. Give him a little more pop. Yeah.
More power and, for sure.
I was there when the match he lost to Djokovic, it was a Wimbledon final. And I remember.
Me too.
Yeah. Were you commentating too for Swiss TV?
Yeah, I was commentating. It was a nightmare.
Wasn't for Djokovic, but it was for Roger. But Roger's still able to, you know, live with that, right? Like, he's able to live, you know, like you said, he's relaxed, he's accepted it. I mean, he's this far away on the first serve at 40-15 from acing him for the match.
Yeah, but it took him a couple of days this time, to be honest. Yeah, it took him a couple of days. But, you know, the fact that you have kids, you have a wife, I mean, you cannot, like, just sit to your kids, you know, I don't want to speak to you for a week.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I think he was a little bit dumb. I know that he was hurt, and for me, it was a nightmare. Honestly, as a commentator, you know, I was sure he's going to win the match. And I remember the next day waking up and said, was it a dream last night, a nightmare, or it did really happen, you know?
How did that actually happen? Yeah.
Yeah, it was not easy.
It is incredible, the sort of his global popularity. It feels like now, maybe even more than ever, now that he's retired. I mean, I know he's spending more time with the family. They're a little more based in at home, but he's on the road a lot. He's doing so. It's almost like his presence is people. I mean, everybody appreciate him as a player, but now just this, like you said, his personality, who he is as a person, I think is even more exposed now. So people just. It's like when he shows up, it's like royalty showing up, right? It's like, oh, you know, Federer's here. He's a different impact on people.
I mean, do you know any guy who can say something bad about him?
No, I don't. There you go.
It's really simple, right, so, you know.
Yeah. Are we going to see you in Newport, Mark? We would love to have you there for the induction.
Why not? I mean, it would be nice. And I mean, Roger is somebody special for me, definitely.
Well, he's special to a lot of people, and you're special to talk to us here at the Tennis Worthy Podcast, Mark. We appreciate it. I'll look forward to seeing you around the grounds because we're both here at Roland Garros. Well, let me just ask you that before I let you go. When Roger finally won this tournament, let's end on that, because that was the one, you know, one place where it was his kryptonite, obviously mostly Nadal, because I think for many years, Roger was the second best player. So when he finally got it done here, was that a relief to him? Was that ecstasy? How would you describe that?
I think it was a relief, but you remember that year you almost lost to Tommy Haas.
Yeah, I did a podcast with Tommy at the beginning of the year, so he remembered that very well.
You know, it's not easy because, you know, he was a hell of a good player, Roger. I mean, but he had like Nadal. He was like, you know.
That was another level.
Yeah. And, you know, losing the final, and suddenly Nadal is not there. And you said, this is the chance of my life. And it put you a hell of pressure. But I think, you know, I think it was kind of a relief for you.
All right. Last thing, Mount Rushmore of Swiss tennis. So Roger.
Roger, Martin Hingis.
Yep.
And Stan.
And Stan. What about you? So are you Olympic gold? Come on.
No, I haven't won a slam, so come on. I was all the
winning Olympics.
Okay, I won the Olympics, but
yeah, I'll put you on there.
It's not up to me to say it, you know. If I could have helped those guys or inspired those guys, I'm pleased with that, and it's fine with me.
Well, it sounds like you did exactly that with Roger. We appreciate you joining us here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast. We will welcome you, Mark, with open arms to Newport for the Roger Federer induction. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Mark Grosse, everyone, on the Tennis Worthy Podcast.